Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to Mazda's focus to ensure every element of a car is designed around the driver. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. As we begin 2020, the economy is booming here and around the country. The stock market is soaring. The real estate market in Charlotte is tight, and home prices are high, but interest rates are fairly low. Unemployment here is also low, and the population is growing, which is why you see all the residential and business construction sprouting up everywhere. Though not everyone is sharing in these economic good times, what we're living through now is a far cry from what we experienced about a decade ago, the worst recession since the Great Depression. It could be argued that if this keeps up, this will be seen as the beginning of the new Roaring Twenties. The question is, will this continue, and where are we headed right now? So let's get some expert opinions. Mark Vittner is Managing Director and Senior Economist for Wells Fargo. Welcome back.
Good to be back.
Good to see you. Tracy Dotson is here. She's Assistant City Manager and Economic Development Director for the City of Charlotte. Thank you for coming back.
Thank you for having me.
And Ashley Fay is here. She's back. She covers real estate for the Charlotte Business Journal. Good morning to you.
Good morning.
If you have questions or comments, you can email us at charlottetalks@wfae.org. Look for WFAE on Facebook. Get to us through Twitter at Charlotte Talks. You can also see the back of Mark Vittner's head on Facebook Live this morning. So, Mark, let me begin with you since your back is to the camera. The economy it seems to be trucking along. From a layperson's point of view, is it?
Yeah, economy's pretty good. I mean, certainly not everybody is benefiting, but more people are benefiting from the improvement in the economy today than we've seen in quite some time. I mean, you look at measures of consumer confidence, the highest since the late 1990s, and that's even with the Iraq problem and the Iran problem, I should say, and the coronavirus. Mm. Even with those two big headwinds, consumer sentiment reached its highest level since the late 1990s.
Why does something like the coronavirus, which is may or may not be a serious pandemic, I mean, it may be, may not be. We had some guests on this program last week who said, so why do things like that, the unknowns like that, which are likely not necessarily to play out, have such a at least an immediate effect on the economy and or the stock market?
Well,
and then it goes back to normal.
Yeah, they get a lot of headlines, for one, and right. So that's what raises the angst of the public. But I think that the greatest threat to the economy is that so much stuff is made in China. And if they have to shut down production, then supply chains break down.
Well, Hyundai has because they're looking for new suppliers for the stuff they get from China.
But most medicines that we take in the United States have ingredients that are imported from China. Yeah. So if we have a very extended shutdown, then we're going to have some problems. Similar to what we saw after the Fukushima nuclear disaster and earthquake, where we saw global growth slow in the two quarters after that.
So how's the Charlotte economy in relationship with the national economy? Better, worse, about the same?
We are doing very well. I think that in the last 2 years, we've probably been the third fastest growing major metropolitan area in the country. And I base that off some real-time data that we get from LinkedIn, which tracks the number of new members that we have in the Charlotte area relative to the existing base. And Charlotte has consistently climbed up that list. And I also base it by all the foot traffic in South End.
So this recovery has been going on since the Great Recession. How would you compare the health of this recovery and the length of this recovery to previous?
Well, it's the longest we've ever had. It's similar in some regards to what we saw in the 1990s. In the 1990s, we started off slow, and then it really took off after the tech boom kicked in. When we started the 1990s, we didn't know what the internet was, and so in the second half of the 90s, we had the internet boom. Today, it's more of a data-driven boom. It's more cloud computing and data analytics. That's where the growth really is. And I was explaining to someone yesterday. I said, "How do we have this growth and no inflation?" I said, "Well, we have a new currency, which is data. And so when you go to Harris Teeter and use your Vic card, you're paying them with currency and you're paying them with data, and that data helps them make their operations more efficient." And we're seeing that all throughout the economy, where we've had this big boom in data analytics, which is allowing us to do so much more and still not have a run-up in inflation.
And is part of the health of this recession and the length of this recession due to the fact that we had no place to go but up?
Well, when we came out of the recession, we heard a lot of that, and we actually published a paper on that that said, is the deeper the recovery, the stronger the recovery? Is it really that simple? Mm-hmm. And we showed that statistically there isn't a relationship between the depth of the recession and the strength of the recovery. And a lot of folks, we wrote that because Larry Summers was saying, we're gonna come roaring back. They were projecting 4% GDP growth, and I said, yeah, I just don't see it. And to me, every recession casts a shadow over the subsequent economic recovery. Mm-hmm. And the deeper the recession, the greater the shadow. It takes longer to get out from under that shadow. And I really think we've only got out from under that shadow in the last couple of years. I mean, it really is because you had the hangover from the housing bust, and that made it very difficult for a lot of people to move. And so the cities that have been growing very rapidly have been the cities that have been attracting young people that didn't have a house that they couldn't sell. So yeah, they've come and they've rented apartments. And in Charlotte's been, we were fortunate that Charlotte is one of those 16 cities.
So we're trucking along, but do you see any potential speed bumps or problems ahead, either, you know, structural problems here nationally, globally, that might get us into trouble down the road?
I really don't see any of the traditional stumbling blocks, which is kind of scary that we're 10 and a half years out and we haven't overbuilt housing. We didn't overbuild commercial real estate. I know when you look at all the cranes around Charlotte, you're worried about that a little bit, but we really haven't. We built only about 15% as much office, industrial, and retail space in this cycle as we build in a typical cycle. And we haven't overdone it in car sales. We're running right around replacement demand and haven't overdone it in capital spending. Those four areas, they make up 20% of GDP, but they account for over 100% of the drop in a recession.
Although I read an article about car sales the other day that new cars are so expensive now, and there's so many cars coming off 1, 2, and 3-year leases that people are gravitating once again toward the used car market and not the new car market, and that's going to have to cause new cars either to change price points or have interest-free loans and things like that.
Well, there's always something up the auto industry's sleeve. It's interesting. We say cars, and we're really talking about light vehicles because car sales have been dwindling, and everybody's been buying crossovers and SUVs. And the thing about motor vehicle sales is that they've been running around 16.5 million units. That's the replacement demand. So if we get worried if we were running at 18 million units and running above that. So so we're not overdoing it in the auto sector.
So Tracy Dotson is here. She's the assistant city manager and in charge of economic development for the city of Charlotte. From the city's perspective, I guess the powers to be must be pretty happy with how we're doing in terms of growth and development and all the people coming in here and bringing their money with them. But what kinds of challenges does that give you in city government?
So just to start, we are very happy with the growth that we've seen. We changed a model a couple of years ago about how we recruit businesses and how we retain businesses, and we've seen a lot of success from that. One of the key things that we are doing now, though, in understanding is that talent, it's the city that we're building. And so how do we keep up? And part of that is with our infrastructure. So now when we talk to businesses, we're bringing in the airport, we're bringing in transportation and transit and having conversations to make sure that we can stay in front of it. Another thing that we are doing with city council is really talking about where we make our investments, not only the parts of our city that need it the most, but also talking about where are the jobs. Mm-hmm. So we keep that accessibility and in our infrastructure.
And Mark mentioned, I think you said it was the third fastest growing metropolitan area in the country. Is that what you said?
Yeah, a major metropolitan.
So are you still, is the city and the county still actively recruiting still more people to come in?
We are not turning away businesses.
We're open for business.
We are definitely open for business. Like I said, we changed the model a couple of years ago about how we work with businesses to either retain and grow them here. The ones that are here are very important, and also the ones that are looking at Charlotte to come in.
What is the in-migration rate now? It keeps changing. We keep being told it's 90 people a day, 110 people a day. Do you know what the rate is? Do we know how many
people? It varies. It depends on whether it's net growth. I think that here for the region, we hear the 120 people a day. I think for Charlotte, it's slightly lower than that, and about 60 to 70.
Anybody leaving?
We have people leaving, too. We like to think that we're keeping more people there.
You know, a lot of the leaves, though, when you look at that leave data, a lot of that is our children going to college, yeah. not mm-hmm. children, but young adults going to college.
So they're not really leaving. They're just temporarily leaving to go to school
and come back, maybe. You can see the data on where people are moving from one county to the other and say, wow, a lot of them are going to Chapel Hill, a lot of them are going to Wake County. And
so every time Ashley Fahey has been here from the Charlotte Business Journal as the real estate editor, we talk about how nothing is moving in the real estate market, or it's taking a long time because everybody's scared to move because the inventory is so low and mm-hmm. people are still coming in. That's mm-hmm. still the case, right?
That is absolutely still the case. Demand just is far outpaced the supply. Home builders are having a hard time finding lots. They're having a hard time finding, especially in Mecklenburg County. It's just very hard to do it. That's why you see a lot of these infill projects, townhouses are coming up everywhere, just because developers have to maximize what they can find and the land prices.
And when you say homes, mm-hmm. Are you talking about single family homes, or are you talking about apartments and townhomes and things that seem to be everywhere now?
Yeah. So in this context, I'm largely talking about for sale housing. So anything where you go in and you buy a house, whether it's a townhouse or a detached house or what have you. But yeah, we've been seeing this for years. We're seeing home builders going out into counties outside of Mecklenburg. We're seeing them, you know, do denser product, which has created a lot of tension in Charlotte because some of these single family neighborhoods, they're worried it's going to change the character. But when you have a city growing as fast as Charlotte and, you know, the land prices are just going up because of demand, because of people want to be in this part of town, I mean, that's just the reality we're facing. So I think a lot of what this city, I'm sure, and the county and everyone else is dealing with is sort of how to walk that line of, well, we want to preserve these neighborhoods. We want to make sure people are happy where they live. We want to manage traffic. But developers at the same time say, well, we need to build housing. People need housing here.
We also see the melding of South End and Uptown and other areas where there are there's a lot of construction going on for retail, but primarily office with retail mm-hmm. below. How would you compare the commercial real estate market to the residential real estate market?
They're very different markets, obviously, right. But I think the demand is just high in both. I mean, you look at the statistics. I think I pulled a bunch here, and Charlotte's housing market had some of the highest percentage price gains in housing in the last few months of 2019. On the office market side, we also saw the fastest rental rate growth, just because the vacancy rates are super low, demand is super high. As soon as a tower gets announced, an anchor tenant pretty much leases it within a couple of months. So, that demand is driving up prices, it's driving up everything. And I think we're just going to continue until something happens in the larger economy or for some reason a business stops coming here. But we're going to continue to see that demand.
Economists expect, I'm told, real GDP growth to be around 2% this year in 2020 after a 2.3% gain last year. And I remember you sitting here, Mark, 11, 12, 13 years ago when growth was much bigger than that. Why are we so excited about 2%?
Well, the base is bigger. So it's when you have a $20 trillion economy, it's harder to grow 2% than when it was a $15 trillion economy. So that's one factor that's at play. But our potential growth rate, what's needed to keep the unemployment rate steady, is probably somewhere around 1.8%, according to the Congressional Budget Office. So if we grow 2%, the unemployment rate's probably going to come down a little bit. So I don't know that people are real excited about it. Certainly the president said he wants 3%. It's awfully hard to get there with the very sluggish labor force growth that we have right now. We've got an older population, and by the end of this decade, all the baby boomers will be retired, and so we're having a tough time finding workers.
What about all those millennials and Gen Xers and people like they're coming up? They're coming through the pipeline, right?
Aren't that many Gen Xers relative to the baby boomers? There are plenty of millennials. I'm actually a little bit more optimistic about long-term growth because I think that the millennials, I think that their skill set, once they have more experience in the workforce, I think their skill set's going to allow productivity growth to be stronger.
Mark Vintner is a senior economist at Wells Fargo. He's here with Tracy Dodson from the City of Charlotte and Ashley Fahey, the real estate editor for the Charlotte Business Journal. We're coming right back at Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, dedicated to those who believe a car should stir one's emotions and deliver a heightened state of driving. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're here with Mark Fitner, senior economist from Wells Fargo, Tracy Dotson, assistant city manager and director of economic development for the city of Charlotte, and Ashley Fay, real estate editor for the Charlotte Business Journal. You say, Mark, that this 2% growth that you're predicting for 2020 will actually feel more like 2.3% growth, or feel better than the 2.3% growth of 2019. Why?
Well, in 2019, we started at 3% and we decelerated. And in the fourth quarter of 2019 and the first quarter of 2020, which we're in right now, are probably going to be the low point. The first quarter is going to be weak because Boeing shut down their assembly line. That's going to reverberate throughout the economy. And then we also have the effects of the coronavirus. But we're going to gain momentum over the course of the year. Yeah. And our forecast for 2021 is 2.3% growth. So it's going to feel a little bit better because at the end of the year, we will have been gaining momentum rather than losing it.
How does the average person experience it? You say it's going to feel better. How will I feel better? How do I experience this at the grocery store or when I'm trying to buy a house or a car or a necktie?
With the GDP numbers, the quarterly number is an accounting number, and so people don't feel the GDP number. That doesn't necessarily relate to their income. And job growth has been very strong. Numbers that we saw this morning, 250,000 or so jobs created in the first month of the year. And people feel pretty good about the economy. I think that the Federal Reserve, Jay Powell, the Federal Reserve has been doing a survey, and Jay Powell recently stated that in their conversations with low and middle income families, mainly in smaller towns and rural areas around the economy, around the country, that the message that they were giving the Fed is that the economy was better today than any point in their lifetimes.
Wow.
Which is just an incredible statement.
So last month at the city council retreat, you presented a pretty extensive economic outlook to city council members, and council member Braxton Winston pointed out, put your headphones on for a second so you can hear this, he pointed out that a good economy doesn't always benefit everyone.
Economic numbers don't always tell the entire picture, right? And I hope that we all, as a body, as a policy-making body, we look between those numbers, right? Because economic data, you know, for all the economic numbers you gave us, that doesn't really equate to the quality of life of our constituents, right? A good war will drive those economic numbers up. Poverty is very profitable and drives those numbers up. Natural disasters, as you showed us, drive those numbers up. So they don't really tell us very much without critical analysis of what we're doing necessarily well.
You pointed out to him that there's no such thing as a good war, but but what about the other things he brought up?
Well, there's one point that he had on there was spot on, which is that a natural disaster, it wipes out wealth, but then the recovery from a hurricane or an earthquake actually shows up in economic growth, and people aren't really better off. But there is this perception out there that poverty serves the interests of someone else, and it really doesn't. If we could eliminate poverty by 10%, the economy would be immensely better off. And if we could eliminate it by 50%, it would be immensely better off. Nobody benefits from
people being
poor.
Well, let me ask you this then, because part of the problem that we're facing in Charlotte with the lack of affordable housing is a twofold problem. It's the lack of affordable housing stock. It's also wages that don't pay enough to afford to live anywhere in the city of Charlotte. So if it really would benefit the economy at large, where we could have fewer people in poverty, more people being able to afford a house or an apartment and a car and a way to get to work and medical care and clothing for their kids and food so they don't have to live in food deserts, why don't we raise wages? What's wrong with business?
Well,
if you pay your employees so they can buy what you make, isn't that a good thing? Didn't Henry Ford make that abundantly clear?
I'm not quite sure about the Henry Ford. I haven't researched it to see if it was actually just a something that we've heard so many times that we think it happened or it actually did. But wages can't rise faster than productivity. If wages rise faster than productivity, whoever's paying the wages is going to go broke. It's a mathematical certainty.
Right.
And so the key is to boost productivity, and it's also...
But aren't we at the highest productivity levels ever, period?
Well,
can you get much more blood out of that turnip?
Productivity growth is really not that strong.
Really?
It's been, and that's one of the reasons why we only have 2% GDP growth. And so part of the problem is that the baby boomers are retiring, and they've been in the workforce the longest. They're the most experienced, the highest productive workers. the millennials are still starting out. The median age is just 30, and so that's why I differ with the base economic forecast that's out there by the CBO. I think that productivity growth is actually going to improve because we're going to see that the millennials are their productivity growth is going to turn out to be stronger. But we need to provide what's missing in the economy is that folks are finding themselves stuck in lower paying jobs for longer periods of time.
Right.
And we somehow the progression out of those low paying jobs just isn't there. I think that a lot of this is it's a combination of a lot of factors. There's no single solution to it. But one of the problems is that folks aren't aware of the opportunities that exist for them. And by the time they become aware of it, they've already completed all their schooling, but almost every job today now requires some sort of certification, some sort of credential. And so there's no way that folks are stuck.
You mentioned LinkedIn a second ago. In this interconnected world in which we live, why are people unaware?
I don't know. There's too much information
all
out
right.
there in some regards.
I think they just
swallow with it. But they're not. They don't become aware of it at the right point in their lives.
You wanted to chime in here. I can
yes.
tell, Tracy. Go ahead.
For Charlotte, we're trying to be so much more intentional about this. And so we look at the companies that we're growing. We look at the wages. How does that compare to other companies that we've attracted? And trying to really bring in jobs that offer a full spectrum. So we might have, we did an announcement last year of a company called Chime Solutions. They paid $14 an hour. We talked to them about that. Why was that? Why could we get that wage up? But then we also talked to them about what are the other services? What are the other things? Because it's not just the housing component. It's the connectivity, the accessibility to the jobs. It's things like childcare. And so this company, while they pay what they offer on-site childcare. We talked about them locating in a location where it's easier to get to the jobs on a transit line or near bus lines and things like that. And so we're being much more intentional about all of the factors that companies and the full spectrum. But the other thing that we're doing is in working with a company like Chime is as people leave that, how do they use that then to get to the next level job? Mm-hmm. So announcements are great, but we can't stop. And what our intent is, we can't stop with just an announcement. We have to be intentional about making sure that if that's an entry level position, how do we connect those employees to the next opportunity so that they can grow in their experience and their wages.
Mark mentioned baby boomers getting out of the way, but something else is going on too. I know that the city's been working hard to attract millennials for whatever reason, and we're certainly doing that, but we've also been named the number one city for baby chasers. Now that's a new term for me. So what are baby chasers and why are they important?
So the baby chasers are the baby boomers essentially that have retired and are following their kids. I'm an example of that. My mother moved to Charlotte after she retired. But what's important with that, and as we talk about talent and opportunity, is as they retire, do they want to do other things in the workforce as they come to Charlotte? And what are the opportunities there? And so we're thinking not only about the millennials and people that are early in their careers and training, but we're also thinking about the other end of the spectrum and what those opportunities might be for our community.
So is the arrival of baby chasers something that is significant? Are we getting a lot of these people? Are they adding to the congestion here?
I think we are getting a lot of them. I come from the real estate world prior to the city and have seen that in terms of housing and things like that. I think it also makes us a more diverse city. We are getting a lot of people coming from all over.
So that leads me to my next question. When these baby chasers arrive, are they looking for the single family home in the burbs, or do they want a condo uptown because they want to downsize and have, you know, be able to walk out the door and lock it and go on vacation and not have to worry about it?
I think you're actually seeing quite a range, because some of these apartments that are renting in Uptown and South End, yes, a lot of them are attracting people that are in their 30s or 20s, but you are actually seeing, especially in some of the uptown towers, some of the more upscale ones, perhaps, you are seeing a lot of baby boomers renting apartments in uptown. And I think that's not a new phenomenon for a city. It could be new for Charlotte, but you're just seeing these boomers that are coming back or are saying, I just don't want to live in a, you know, huge mansion in South Charlotte or a large home in Foxcroft anymore. I don't want to have to deal with the maintenance of a yard and a large home. So a lot of them are downsizing into smaller units. experience, we are seeing some condo units coming online, and they're getting sold super quickly in areas like Dilworth and Myers Park. And then I just think that just underlines the kind of demand that people are looking for smaller spaces.
What are you hearing from realtors? Because I know that for a while, things just weren't moving because people were afraid to sell their homes because they couldn't find any place to move to unless they were leaving town.
Yeah.
What are you hearing from them?
I mean, that's definitely still going on. I think people are holding on to their homes because they see that this market is just insane. It cooled off a little bit last year as far as the seller's market and all this other stuff, but people are holding on to their homes. They're just saying, you know, I don't know where I'm going to go. There's just not enough inventory out there. First-time home buyers are having a hard time finding the right price points.
Prior to the recession, home builders were building a lot of entry-level housing. That's not happening so much anymore. What happens to those people?
I think they just kind of get pushed out farther and farther. I think that's the reality we're seeing. We're seeing a lot more, more of that entry-level price point going out to areas outside of Mecklenburg just because, as I said earlier, it's just gotten really expensive to build comparatively to other parts of town. So it's harder to build that entry-level price point in Charlotte like it used to be.
So it's a seller's market, I take it. Right?
Yes.
So how much is housing going up in price month by month, year by year?
I think the stat I had was annual growth last year, I think, was like 5%, 6% year over year, which was one of the higher percentage-wise in the country just because, again, the demand is so high. People just aren't finding the homes that they, you know, the price levels, I guess, that they expect to find, and it takes them a lot longer to buy a house. And again, I think this is resulting into a little bit of a migration outward to other counties.
And if you're a seller, because it's a buyer's market and things are so tight, do you have to fix it up before you sell it, or you just put it on the market, and if you like it, fine, you fix it?
Well, anyone in real estate will tell you to fix it up before you sell it. But yeah, you're seeing kind of a range. I think it is in their interest probably to fix it up because you could get a better price. But it is such a competitive market that a lot of people are buying homes and willing to put a little bit of equity into it to get it up to speed after they buy it.
And one of the things that's driving this in-migration in Charlotte is that job growth is up. You say it's really good. Those were your words, really strong. And you believe that will continue, Tracy, to be strong and, more importantly, more stable. What does that mean and why has it happened?
Well, the growth that we've seen of, again, expanding companies that are already in Charlotte to also new companies coming in, we're getting very focused around tech jobs. Mm-hmm. We're seeing a lot of growth in that area. And I think that some of this momentum that we have is telling the world that Charlotte is open for business. And so that we're showing up more consistently, I think, on searches for large companies. We are making a deliberate effort in Europe with tech companies to actually consider Charlotte. They know New York. They know Silicon Valley, but they don't always know Charlotte. And so I think that some of this momentum that we have with announcements like Lowe's last year with 2,000 tech jobs, Honeywell at the end of the year before, is spurring a lot of that momentum.
So one of the things that Charlotte wanted to do after the Great Recession was to diversify its economy. We had too many eggs in the banking basket, and although banking has come back, we're trying to diversify into other areas. And because banking had all these tech workers, it seemed like a natural thing to do to have a lot of fintech people around, and we're attracting more. Are we diversifying in other ways? Because it seems to me that they keep saying that if you want a long-lasting job, they said this 10 years ago, you go into computers, you go into coding, you go into this, you go become a programmer. And then suddenly all those jobs were gone because they can do those in India. So is fintech the way to go, and are we diversifying beyond technology?
I think fintech was a great start for us in terms of diversifying, and it is still strong here with our banks. But I think we are growing more in the overall tech world. And again,
does that mean?
All different types. If you look at Honeywell and what Honeywell does to have their headquarters here.
And thermostats in my world, what do they do?
They do all kinds of technology, from technology in airplanes and airports to smart city. They really are repositioning themselves as not the company that is known as an industrial company or the thermostat company, but really a company that solves technology problems. And so they look at a wide range of services. Lowe's, thinking about the announcement they made last year to do their tech center here. you know, that is about repositioning how that company works from a technology standpoint, website, everything. But also, I think the opportunity we have here is around healthcare and technology. With having Navant and Atrium here, there's a huge opportunity with that as well.
So we have job growth in Charlotte, and I guess job growth around the country. But you also say, Mark, that job growth nationally is moderating as the labor market is tightening, because as you just said a minute ago, we don't have enough qualified people for a lot of these jobs. But you also point to retailers and restaurants hiring fewer workers because of rising wages and salaries, which are crimping profit margins. Aside from the cooks, who do they pay? The waiters don't make any money. That's all coming in through tip revenues.
Well, what you're seeing is that in the restaurant industry, they're going to a fast casual concept, sort of like Chipotle or Panera Bread. They may have a kiosk that you order from, and so they're taking a lot of labor out. Part of it is that they just have a hard time finding workers. And then in the case of New York and California, it's some very large increases in the minimum wage, and that's really sped it up a little bit. And so on Friday, when we get the employment numbers, you're going to see that we added 500,000 fewer jobs than are reported today during the 2019. 60% of that reduction will be in retail trade and the restaurant industry.
Is that because they don't want to pay the higher wages and they can't afford it, so they lay people off? Or is it because, particularly in retail, people are buying everything from Amazon, you don't need people on the floor?
Well, in retail, it's primarily because of the competition from online retailing. Right. And we're going to see an upward revision to the number of jobs added in technology and in transportation and distribution.
So I think I heard you say that part of this is being driven by the rising minimum wage in states where they have mandated a certain minimum wage, like California. Does this bode well for Democratic candidates who advocate raising the minimum wage nationally?
You know, I think that proposals to raise the minimum wage always poll relatively well because it's very hard to see all the connections. Mm-hmm. But where it creates dislocations is when you suddenly increase it by a large amount.
Right.
If it stays at that amount, then people adjust to it.
Right.
But that shock generally causes folks to say, let's see if we can control our compensation costs.
And you have said that wages and salaries are growing fastest for folks at the lower half of the wage spectrum, and that this is a change from earlier in the expansion. So two questions. Is that related to what we're just talking about with retailers and restaurants, or why is this happening?
Well, it is the increase in minimum wage is part of it. I mean, that is because New York and California are two very large areas, and so when you had the higher minimum wage there, that certainly impacted the numbers. But part of it's just the tightening of the labor market, and the wage growth at the lower end is 4.7%. At the upper end, it's 2.3. So it's
2.3% of six figures is a lot more money than 4% of
absolutely.
Whatever. Yeah.
But when you look at it on a chart, at the lower end, it looks like a hockey stick, and so it's accelerating. So this is an encouraging sign. It doesn't mean that suddenly we've solved income inequality, but we're making steps in that direction.
And when we come back, we talk about how this, what we're talking about right now, relates to the real estate situation in Charlotte with Ashley Fay from the Charlotte Business Journal, Mark Vintner from Wells Fargo, and Tracy Dotson from the City of Charlotte. We're coming right back. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. So, Ashley Fay, real estate editor of the Charlotte Business Journal. We've been talking about job growth and how people are moving here, and wages, at least at the low end, appear to be rising. But we still have this affordable housing problem in Charlotte, and rents everywhere are going up because demand is so high. Is there any relief in sight? How much more can people pay?
You know, honestly, it's hard to know until we see what the demand is like. As long as demand is there, as long as people are moving here, as long as people are leasing apartments and office space, the rents will grow. And that's in part of what makes Charlotte an attractive market for some groups. It's a lot of institutional investors.
What, come here and pay more in rent?
Well, no, because they can get an institutional investor can come and come in and get more return if they buy an office building at one price and are able to increase the rents. I mean, that's just basic economics. But as far as what this means for people here, you know, it's really challenging. I think people are just, in some ways, a sticker shock because we've never seen the rate of growth that we've experienced just because of how fast Charlotte's growing. The rate of growth has been exponential, and even people who are staying in place in an apartment can see a huge increase in their
rent.
What's
the average rent?
The average rent, I think, for the entire city was around $1,170 at the end of 2019. But in Southland or Midtown, it's around $1,600.
Okay, so to me, that's a mortgage payment. So what kind of worker, what money do you have to make to be able to afford that and to justify that in your mind?
I mean, you have to take into account, do you have a roommate? Are you splitting the rent with someone? I think to live in Southland, I think the average median wage there might be around $80,000. I can't remember. It might be around $70,000. Across the city, I think it's closer to $45,000, $50,000. I don't remember exactly what the current median wage is. But, you have to just look at how creative you can get with your space. And the problem, I think, though, has been in this cycle, a lot of the new apartment construction has been upscale, luxury, amenity-laden type of product. And I think that's just because in a place like Southend, when you buy a piece of land, it costs so much more than what it used to. And so developers are saying, well, to get the maximum return, I have to build sort of this more upscale type of product. And that inevitably, that drives up rents, even existing product in that area. So I think where we're seeing, I think Mark's report has mentioned this too, we're seeing this crunch for sort of that middle market. We're seeing people who just are making, whatever per hour or whatever annually, they just cannot afford some of this new product. They can't afford the new
construction. But when a new piece of product comes online and it's the latest, greatest, the best refrigerator and the high-end appliances and the marble countertops and whatever else constitutes luxury, the saltwater swimming pool on the roof and the dog walks around the building, doesn't that drive the cost down of the Johnny-come-lately, the apartment that was built last week that doesn't have that?
Not necessarily. I mean, in some cases, yes, yet that's where naturally occurring affordable housing is. But in an area like South End, Midtown, there's just so much demand and so much interest in those submarkets that, it doesn't necessarily moderate the rents too much.
So the other thing that I'm sorry to
say, the strongest rent growth now is actually not in those high end apartments. It's actually in more of the suburban apartments and the apartments geared toward workforce housing.
That's a good thing, isn't
it? It's a good thing for the people, maybe not so necessarily for who's paying for it, but rent increases have actually slowed for the higher end apartments because there's just been so many that have hit the market all at one time. But the one thing about the apartment market is that Charlotte, and the housing market too, Charlotte is very affordable for people that move here. And because so many people are moving here, it makes it unaffordable for the people who live here already.
And it's affordable for people who move here because they're coming from higher-priced cities?
They're coming from the West Coast. They're coming from Texas. They're coming from New York.
So this is cheap to them.
Well, it's relatively affordable for them.
Yeah.
And we've seen this in all of the markets that are growing very rapidly. Right now, Charlotte and Raleigh are two of the more affordable markets of the rapidly growing market.
Well, that's what makes it attractive for businesses to come here because they can keep their salaries where they were in California or even lower them. And when people come here from those locations, they find out the cost of living is so much cheaper. Doesn't that make the snowball even bigger than it was before as people discover this?
I think there's a couple of things. Yes, they find that it's easy to do business. It's affordable to do business in Charlotte. But there's other things that we hear, too. It's the quality of life, congestion, things like that. They're coming from usually a larger, more metropolitan areas. And so there's a whole mixture of things when they're coming in.
Well, you said congestion, so let me get to it.
We were going to get here.
We were coming.
It seems to me that as more people come here, that's one of the key challenges that any municipality would have. Infrastructure and roads and transportation. I don't mean just transit, but I mean transit and roads. Can we possibly keep pace with this? Are we always going to be playing catch up and falling farther and farther behind?
So one of the things I'll say is I give the mayor and city council a lot of credit. It's a constant discussion, housing, connectivity in all forms, and transportation and jobs. And so we can't take our eye off the ball of any of them, and we constantly have to be talking about them. We recognize our growth, and I said earlier how when we're attracting companies, I'm bringing in the people who are dealing with transportation. I'm bringing in John Lewis. I'm bringing in Liz Babson and Brent Cagle from the airport so that they're hearing what companies are saying, and we're keeping all of that in the forefront so we don't get behind. Mm-hmm. We're going to have very strategic investments around our transportation. That's roads. That's mass transit as well to keep up with this growth.
Where's that money coming from?
We're going to have to get a lot of different sources for the money.
Why isn't the growth paying for itself? It never does.
Well, if you look at a lot of the new growth that we're coming in is generating new taxes. We talked about commercial office space and where we are. What we're seeing now, a lot of the new companies that are inbound companies are building new office buildings and new space. That's going to generate more tax revenue.
Okay. The president last night made the State of the Union address, and as any president would, he touted the economy, which is very good. Some of which he's probably responsible for. Others of it, his predecessor was, in spite of the fact that he took credit for it. But he also points a lot to the stock market, which for people who are invested in the stock market, this has been a glorious time to be invested. And if you have a 401k and you invested properly, you've probably seen significant growth in your 401k. How much of the success in the stock market is due to happenstance, and how much is due to the president's policies, Mark?
Well, the stock market generally reflects the economy. It reflects the present value of future cash flows and for the businesses. And so, you know, the economy looks pretty good, so the stock market looks pretty good. The president's policies have helped.
Which ones?
I think that rolling back of regulations and tempering some of the zeal that regulations were being enforced at has had a very meaningful effect. And we saw that in business confidence measures, and we saw that in capital spending up until the trade war, which kind of had the opposite effect and really dampened capital spending. So, you know, I think that probably helped the most. And the tax reform, it wasn't perfect. It wasn't perfectly timed, but it did have a positive effect.
Who benefited most from that? We'll talk about this tomorrow.
It's really hard to tell. I mean, I would say that it seems to me that it's been fairly broad based, though, and because it coincides with the improvement in wage gains at the lower end of the spectrum. So it may be because we haven't seen that much capital spending.
Some believe that if the president is reelected, he will try again to lower taxes. I don't know if that's true or not, but some have said that. He'll need the support if they remain in control of the House. He'll need support of very reluctant Democrats to do that because they'd like to have health care and other things that the campaign's based on, the forgiveness of student loan debt and things like that. Would Republicans go for this? Because we have an email question. Dennis emails, what about the record debt and the deficit? A few years ago, this was a huge concern. Is it not now? These two numbers seem very worrisome. Would Republicans go for another tax cut?
I think it would be hard. I do think we could see some sort of tax reform that wouldn't result, that as long as it, you know, it's revenue neutral or enhances revenues, but that's kind of a tough thing to pull off. But the reason why the debt, and when he talks about the debt so much right now, is that Japan and Germany and Europe are in so much worse shape, and their demographics are a whole lot worse, where they're a whole lot. So we're the cleanest dirty shirt in the closet, and people want to buy U.S. Treasuries because we have a positive yield. Their yields are close to zero or negative. And so there's this huge appetite for our Treasury securities that won't last forever. And so we've kind of been lulled into this. Well, though the folks were crying wolf all this time, and the deficits don't matter. They do matter. And at some point in this decade, it's going to come back and bite us.
So we have this robust economy, which started under President Obama, and he inherited the worst economy since the Great Depression. But it is roaring. We're doing really well. And as you said earlier in the program, there's no sign that any of this is really going to change. But we are facing an election. And we have Democratic candidates with a diametrically opposed view of what should happen here. What would be the impact of a Democratic president?
Well, we have Democratic candidates that are diametrically opposed
what
to each other,
what would be the impact
too?
Of Bernie Sanders or Elizabeth Warren getting the presidency?
You know, I think that that a Bernie Sanders presidency would probably be fairly problematic because we would probably see the dollar get hit pretty hard right away, and the deficit would probably come home to roost almost immediately in that kind of way because of fears that we would go into some sort of hyper-regulated economy. And the thing is that I think that as people would sit back, even if Bernie was to be elected, it would really depend on what kind of Congress.
Right.
There's only certain things that the president could do. The president
may not be true anymore.
But the president does have control over a great deal of the regulatory agencies. And that's why, you know, when Trump came in, he was able to reduce regulations fairly quickly. Bernie or Elizabeth Warren would probably ramp them up relatively quickly. I think that's one of the things. Beyond that, I really don't know. It really depends on what the makeup of Congress is. I get this question almost every day, and I said, I said Biden, Klobuchar, Buttigieg. Am I leaving somebody out? I don't mean to, Bloomberg. There would probably be less of an immediate change from one of them being elected.
But if I just want to understand, because you're saying on the one hand that if more money is flooding into the economy, and that more money would be from my salary, because it's a consumer economy, if I'm spending less on health care because suddenly I'm covered by national health care, which is what Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren are saying, if I don't have to pay off $60,000 in student debt, I now have $60,000 to spend on a Maserati. So why wouldn't that be beneficial to the economy?
Well, where did that money come from that paid off the student loan debt? And where does that money come from that pays for the health care? It all has to come from the same economy. So I don't know that that works. And I don't think that would help the situation. I think it would actually make the situation worse. The student loan situation that we're in right now has led to runaway college cost, because just like with healthcare, there's a disconnect between who's consuming the service and who's paying for it, and we need to bring that more back towards market mechanisms.
Prior to the recession, in the consumer-driven economy, consumers were putting it all on the credit card, and that was part of the problem. We were financing everything. Are we doing it now?
No, households have been delevering. So if you look at the amount of income that is needed to service debt, mortgages, credit cards, student loans even, it's the lowest share of household income since 1980. Now, it differs a little bit. Homeowners are in far better shape because they've been able to refinance their mortgages than apartment renters. But even among apartment renters, the financial obligation ratio is fairly low right now.
And what about this $1 trillion deficit that the United States of America carries? I mean, there's some debt, it can be argued, particularly in governmental circles, is a good thing because it allows you to do things cheaper today than you could tomorrow, particularly when interest rates are low. But what about this deficit?
Well, most of that debt is owed to ourselves. So someone else owns. So a lot of baby boomers own U.S. treasuries. We have about $20 trillion in debt. China owns about $1 trillion. So, you know, they have about 5% of it. But so it's not inconsequential. But most of the debt is owed to ourselves.
Wow. Charlotte has entered into this opportunity zone. And the president talked about opportunity zones last night in the State of the Union as being a great place to raise the standard of living for a lot of people. Is that what the purpose of these opportunity zones in Charlotte is? Because it seems to me also there's a risk in opportunity zones, and that is gentrification.
The opportunity zones are a very fine line. They were deliberate in the locations that we chose in Charlotte for areas that we thought it could be a carrot to entice investment into those areas. But we've also, as we've talked with council and many others, we do have to be intentional about it not leading to displacement. We have seen some investments in these opportunity zones. Is it because it's an opportunity zone or not because it's an opportunity? It's hard to tell. But that has, we talked about multifamily and apartments. We've seen some investments that will bring new multifamily into some of these areas. It's leading to investment, but yet we also have to be intentional at not leading to displacement.
Is it too early to tell in the real estate field what's going on?
You know, all of last year, everyone was like, what's up with these regulations? I think the IRS released three rounds of regulations from October 2018, the spring of last year, and December of last year. And all through that, people, investors, lawyers, tax attorneys, they were saying, well, we don't know yet. We don't know how this regulation is going to work. But this year, I think we're going to see whether or not these projects or this legislation actually results in an influx of development.
Ashley Fay with the Business Journal, Tracy Dotson with the City of Charlotte, and Mark Bittner from Wells Fargo. You just said everything's hunky-dory. It's going well. What are you most worried about in 10 seconds?
Over? Well, I don't think everything's hunky-dory, and I'm most worried about what I don't know. And it's never the things that we know that are going to trip us up that trip us up. It's the things we don't know.
So stay tuned is the moral of that story. Thank you all for being here. Appreciate it. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to drivers that share Mazda's passion that cars make driving matter. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.